Holly Whitaker. Okay,
Hi.
cool. Hi. Well, hey, check it out. I have to ask you something right when we first start. Did
Yeah.
you know that your book, your New York Times bestseller, Quit Like a Woman, did you know that it was going to be featured on the Sex and the City sequel series?
I did.
And
Yeah,
just
I
like
did.
that?
Yeah. Sam Irby was one of the writers on the show, and she's somebody we had her on our podcast years ago. And then I mean, they had to ask permission. I got Random House asked me. It was no guarantee, so I wasn't sure whether or not. And then but Sam Irby is who put it in there. That was her episode that it appeared in. And I did know about it, but it was still like a shock, seeing it and seeing it in the previews, and it was just like a whole storyline. It wasn't just a throwaway thing. It was just, can I cuss? It was
You
so
can.
fucking cool. Yeah.
That
It was rad.
was so fucking cool,
Yeah.
and it was a main story arc. It was a total focus
Yes.
on
Yes.
multiple episodes.
Yes. Yes, it was. It just, yeah. I mean, like, I'm gonna be on a Wheaties box because I'm giving a talk at General Mills, and being on Sex and the City, like, those are two highlights of my career.
Wheaties. Oh my
Yeah,
God, I'm
they put
the
you on a Wheaties box when you give a talk at General Mills, and that's just.
wow.
I chose a very athletic picture of my. I like looked at like what Wheaties boxes had looked like in the past. You know, like they're athletes like Michael Jordan and Serena. And so I found as athletic of a pose as I could find. So anyway, yeah. So
That is
big stuff.
iconic.
It
You're in
is
the
iconic.
It's literally iconic. A
Well,
Wheaties box. What?
not like it's not gonna be in the stores. I mean, I
Right,
feel
right,
like
right, right.
I don't
Okay.
think anybody made that assumption, but just to be clear, it's just for me. It's just one. But it still is like
I'd still, but it's still
highest
like an
honor.
authorized official one from them.
Yes.
You
Yeah.
know? You know,
Yeah.
not like a bootleg.
You're cutting and pasting.
Yeah. Well, it's not like it's not like you hand wrote Louis Vuitton onto a tote bag. You got
No,
the real McCoy. So
the
congratulations on all of that. And that's your
real
very
thing.
first book that you
Yeah. Yeah, it's
published.
my very first book. Yeah. No
Yeah, you're
pressure
a
for the second
writer.
one.
You're a very skilled and experienced writer. You do a lot of writing. So
Yeah.
writing this book wasn't your first writing project.
Yeah.
You're a prolific writer, and you're actually writing a second
Second book. Yeah.
book.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about that?
What about being a prolific writer? Well, I
No,
do want
about
to
the
talk about
second
that.
book. Yeah.
No, I mean, I do want to talk about one thing because I think it's interesting, which is so I started a blog in 2013. I was an accountant. That was my background. I was working as a director at a tech startup, and I started writing in secret and totally self-taught. And I started a blog in 2014 called Hip Sobriety, and then in 2021, when I was getting pushed out of my company, and I was afraid that they were going to take all of my personal essays that were so deeply personal, I got really scared, and I just deleted a lot of them from the internet, and like deleted some forever, and then just like pulled, like I archived most of them and harvested most of them, and I've been going through those, what I thought was good writing really at the time, and I've reread everything now over the past week, and oh my God, like you know, like hole in my heart, it was so bad. But also
Never
I
read
do.
any of my books, okay? Don't touch any of my
Why?
books.
Wait,
Don't
why?
come anywhere near my books with
Well,
that shit. Well, because
I
I
mean,
relate to that. I relate so much. You know, my books are out. And at the time, I thought they were pretty good, but at the time I had my own problems with them. I was critical at the time too, what much like
sure.
I'm
Well,
sure, you
same.
know,
Yes.
exactly.
But I didn't
But
think, but I thought I was a good writer. And I'm like, oh, Jesus. No. But I will say I was really reading Melissa Phoebos's book Body Work last night, and which is a great book on craft. And she says, thank God, like, I don't write the same as I did when I was 20, you know? And I think that this is this really beautiful thing of like allowing your process to continue on. And like, you know, how sweet was it that I thought that the ibuprofen was good? Like, that's really cute. And, you know, I mean, and also if it just gets better and better, like that's great, you know? So it's, I guess, a good thing that it's all cringe at this point. But yeah, I'm working on a second book. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So I would love to hear about the second book. Like, what can you tell me about the new one?
It's funny because I've been, sometimes I'll talk about it and sometimes I won't, you know, I think of like Joan Didion, how she put her books, she'd work on her manuscript and she'd actually like put the paper in the freezer at night in order to like, you know, like put the process down, like hold the space for the book. And like, I think when I talk about it, sometimes it kind of lets the air out of it. And so I'll say, really it's about this experience, I think, of like, I achieved a lot. I quit my job as an accountant in 2013 or no, early 2014. It was the same, it was about less than a year sober. And I worked in healthcare. I worked at a company that was like at the intersection of health. Like it was really, really at the leading edge of consumer focused healthcare. And as a solution to like what a mess our healthcare industry is. And so I had this like really in-depth experience of understanding how messed up our healthcare system was. And then as somebody that was working to try and fix that, going through recovery and really having been totally on my own outside of the industry and being unable to afford rehabilitation, teaching doctor friends about my process, giving them tips, learning that doctors went to 12-step meetings is, you know, part of their training, and, you know, and really like understanding no one is looking at this issue in a way that's really bringing the best of what we know now. And then also having this other experience of, I really believe that we were going to have a reckoning around alcohol the same way we've had a reckoning around cigarettes, now come to pass. But that was a largely, that was not a popular opinion. You were an addict and you were messed up and you couldn't drink. So anyway, long story short is that I had this like desire to build a company and to really educate the masses and to really change the narrative around alcohol. I wanted to really push this idea that alcohol wasn't something that we were supposed to do. And that we fix the way that we assume, you know, what it is and what's wrong with people that don't consume it or can't consume it, and create, you know, far more holistic recovery solutions. And I did all that, you know, like I wanted to start, I started thinking about it in 2013. I left my job in 2014. I, you know, started a company and by 2019, I'd raised, you know, I ended up raising total around $25 million for this company investors. I was a CEO. At the top of it in 2020, my book came out. It did well. In 2021, it hit the New York Times bestseller list. I closed another round of financing, you know, and I think I had been in Vogue like four different times. There was so much media attention and so much like personal media attention, and then also on the organization, the movement had come to pass. You know, there was, you know, that's how I met, you know, Saw and I met through our like in New York City at an event where we were trying to normalize, you know, recovering, not drinking. And I met him through Ruby Warrington, who's the author of Sober Curious. So all this stuff had happened, and you would think, you know, I bought my first home, you know, you would think like that when you achieve all of the things that you like, they literally were the items on my, you know, I don't do a vision board. I do a vision list every day. I write what I want, you know, and the things like my intentions and what I'm working toward. And I was so empty. There was just this huge gulf between me and my center, and it was getting wider and wider. And I had done all this work. I had spent, you know, the last decade and doing, you know, yoga teacher trainings and immersed in self-help and build and doing, you know, like really, really like giving, like my mission and my dedication and my purpose was totally about helping people. And you would think like with all of that, there would be this sense of direction and grounded, and like that I would be tethered, that I would be, you know, and I was so miserable and I was so confused and I was so lost. And then not long after, I lost it all. Like, I got pushed out of my company. The company's now dissolved, it was acquired by a competitor. Nothing turned out the way, you know, that it was supposed to turn out. And I think like that just, my identity was so yoked to all of that. My identity was yoked to this, the company, to my purpose, to being somebody that talked about sobriety and somebody that talked about alcohol and helped people with that. And not only that, like I lost it all. And there were still articles being written about me, like notably in The Cut, about my company and me as a CEO, and like a whole profile on me a year after I left the company. And it was just like, it was agonizing because I was no longer that. It felt like such a lack and such a failure. And this is the middle, you know, like early pre-pan or post-pan. Like I just, you know, like I really lost my shit. I've never been so, you know, 10 years into recovery, I have never been so, it was the most excruciating pain ever through my entire life. Like the confusion exists. So I think that there's, you know, that's what the book is about. I think that there's, you know, that's really underselling it, because it's also, there's a lot that's happening right now. And I think like, especially like in the discourse, in like how divided we are, in the meaning that we're finding and how we responded to the pandemic, and you know, like the, just like the chaos and the quickness and the pace of everything, and the search for meaning, you know, in all of it. And I think, you know, it's about that. And that's, it's a wide sweeping topic. So it's, you know, I'm boiling it down into something that I, you know, like to write a book for myself, you know, it's a book for myself. It's a book that I wished that I'd had, the same way my first book was a book I wish I'd had. That's a really long, long answer. I'm so sorry.
No, I'm so grateful for all of that. And I think, you know, it's writing a book for ourselves is, you know, one of the most authentic ways to make sure it's a meaningful project and the content of it is meaningful, is if it would be genuinely, authentically helpful to us, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. So often that is our legacy. What do I wish I knew younger?
Yeah.
That's really like our legacy, like that, we can live and leave, you know, for someone else. And I think it's so good that you're taking such a big topic. This idea of our relationship to what's happening on a global large scale, you know?
Yeah.
And we, you know, from a spiritual perspective, you know, we look at the very real reality of this moment, the, you know, just the details and the facts and the figures and where we are in relationship to climate, where we are from like a geopolitical standpoint, wars, and all the countries with their finger on the button, ready to press.
Annihilate us all. Yeah.
You know, tens of thousands of people who never thought they would ever be in military, now in another country training, you know, due to active wars, you know, in, you know, civilian regions. And just sort of like looking at all of that collective stuff, the awareness that we can have of it now from a spiritual perspective, what we have technologically just in the last 100 years, it is something that the rest of our, every single religion that's ever been founded, every single spiritual tradition, no one could have ever expected our tangible ability to have an awareness of what's happening in the
of everything at of, once.
Yeah. And therefore, you know, from as a mindfulness practitioner, as like a meditation person, you know, the, and even in the 12 steps, the first step is the recognition. It's the acknowledgement. It's honesty. It's saying like, this is actually happening. So you have to know something's happening. And then the real first step is from that awareness is you taking the first step, which is I am acknowledging that shit has hit the fan.
Yeah.
And so I love that. That's I can't wait to hear how that unfolds in your book. I can't wait to read it. Because I think that's one of the most important things that a large audience, that masses of people, that exact message needs to be a number one New York Times bestseller for multiple weeks.
Yeah.
Because that message needs to penetrate into the hearts of people who might actually one by one be able to have some kind of influence throughout this process, like whatever's happening. Sometimes I'm like, wow, so much is happening that we can't stop. So much of it we can't stop. But what can I do? I can actually give a shit about the human beings I'm going to encounter.
Thank you. Yes.
Along today. This process. Today. Yeah.
Yes. Now, I feel like that was such a big revelation for me in this, in the pandemic. And I think having conversations with people that just felt like there was nothing they could do. And they were trying to, you know, make these wide sweeping changes. And I do think that we're in this space because we're aware of everything that's happening, every terrible thing that's happening. And we're just like, you know, leaping from one fire to the next, like in our attention and in what we're supposed to care about, which is just so exhausting. And we're not like biologically capable of processing as much information as we're supposed to, like we're supposed to, in quotes. And I think having so many conversations with people that were just felt so completely unable to make any kind of difference or impact and just really weighed down by that and exhausted by that. And then, you know, like the simple conversation, I really, really believe in, and it doesn't mean, I'm a fledgling practitioner in this, but like, I absolutely believe in all of the small things that we do and choosing peace over war, that like, it really, really, it comes down to the individual choices that we make and the actions that we take and what we do in our everyday lives. So it could be as simple as like humanizing other people we deeply disagree with. And not giving into that, you know, like to the dehumanization, name calling, fighting, pettiness. I find that so toxic. Like even if they deserve it, you know, like, even if I think that we've just lost our way. And like, I have had so many conversations about this where people look at me like I'm a fucking freak if I say something along the lines of like, you know, like it's just as device. It's just as harmful to completely dehumanize that person over there that's even doing something awful. You know, mm-hmm. instead of dehumanize, like instead of like actually like seeing their policies are evil or what they're mm-hmm. doing is terrible versus them. You know, mm-hmm. like we just lost our way so much in how we can just the choices that we can make minute by minute and how we relate to other human beings. And it really like, you know, it stops with us. And I think that message is so largely missed because it feels so ineffectual. If you're just being nice to somebody, if you're just like taking a breath before responding to a comment and maybe like not doing something that hurts you a little bit and hurts someone else a little bit, or just like making eye contact with somebody or being nice when somebody's mean or whatever it is. Like we think that's so ineffectual. That's really, I think we're thinking, well, I'm supposed to go like, you know, abroad and work for an NGO and do this, like, which is also, you know, an incredible contribution. But for most of us, the contribution we're going to make is going to be really small and individual and in our hearts. I don't know.
I mean, I completely agree. I think that there's that it's really beautiful that so many of us have these big goals and big visions and big dreams for being able to make a huge difference. And that's so good and create from that place. And I support it and I believe in it, but I think that you're really, really right. It's like our lives, life is what happens while you're making other plans, right?
Yeah.
So I've got these plans to go save the world. And I'm going to do this big, important, I don't know what it is yet, but I know it's going to be big and I know I'm going to save the world, you know, versus trying now, you know, just being available now. One of the things that you do that I think is so cool that you invited Sa and I to participate in is the Feed the Streets initiative, where we're providing meals, you know, a couple times a week, in LA for unhoused people. You know,
unhoused residents of Skid Row, and is where I work or I volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is really sweet, and it's also like I think, and to be really clear, like I absolutely could do a lot more, and this is something that I just started doing when I got to LA, and I think that it was so sweet and refreshing to remember how, like, being in a space where people have absolutely nothing and are so grateful, and where there's just really no separation, it's really direct, like, support, it's mutual aid, and where it's so, I mean, that whole operation is so guerrilla, you know, it's just mm-hmm. like, it's real low organization, it's real, like, just all hands on deck, anybody, you know, all come, bring as much food as you can bring the tampons you have in your car, you know, like, whatever you've mm-hmm. got to give, bring it, come out here, be with people that have absolutely nothing, and seeing the gratitude of people that are so sick, so under, you know, so overlooked, so, you know, like, oh God, like, just forgotten, and well, I think...
I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but that goes right to what you were saying earlier about humanizing people that we disagree with, or even people who are doing really bad, violent things. Opening our hearts, humanizing them so that we can see from the human perspective, where we're never going to disarm someone like Vladimir Putin by continuing to demonize him and demonize Russia and demonize everyone around him. It's like there is a psychological process happening through this person, and and if we look at him as a human and sort of like let go of some of these things where we have these beliefs that person's just fucked from the beginning, that person has lost their shit, and it's, you know, sometimes you do need to, you know when parenting, sometimes you have to grab the child's hand and take the scissors out of their hand to make sure that they're not going to hurt themselves or someone else, you know? But you don't demonize that child for running around with scissors, you know?
Right.
And it does make sense, you know, when it comes to war games, I understand the mentality where people are like, you know what, this situation has gone on so far, so long, it's so bad that military intervention is the only thing. I also understand that perspective, you know, but we do collectively have to start that process of, look, every single one of us is a human. And what does that really mean? What does it mean to be human? Well, we have all kinds of needs.
Yeah.
And we respond to fear and love in these kinds of ways, you know? So it's like the diplomacy coming from a more psychologically intimate space is sort of like the energy that's coming through for me.
Yeah. And I think like it's a pretty big reach for a lot of people to, like, you know, to love towards Vladimir Putin. But as simple as like taking it back a few steps and thinking about, like, you know, like, who are you holding? Like, because it is really, really... It just never hurts the other person. It really, I think it's always fair, like, that it's always poison that we're drinking. Well, I mean, I think it's just in any time we hold any aggression toward anybody, and we think it's, you know, we think we're supposed to, right? Like, we think that it's like a healthy thing to, I mean, it, like, we're getting into all of the gray area around this. Anytime we hold it, like, anytime we're aggressive or toward anybody else, you know, and whether or not their actions warranted it, it's just like, it's just, it cuts us off, poisons us, right? It's drinking the poison ourselves. And I do think that, you know, for me and how I work with a lot of this stuff is first of all, I'm really careful about what I expose myself to. I don't read, you know, I stay enough informed, you know, and typically I stay informed through resources that are not going to be inflammatory. And I stay as basically informed as I need to be without, you know, sitting in front of CNN or MSNBC, you know, on a loop and mm-hmm. just watching the same thing over and over and over again and inciting all of this like fear and anger. And I think also I just like typically really, really am clear, like with what thoughts I'm holding in response to that and what it does to me in response to that. And I think a lot of my practice though is not with like world leaders. It's a lot of it's just with who's around me, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. who I'm interacting with and who are the mm-hmm. biggest, you know, who are the biggest bullies or, you know, people that I disagree with in my own personal realm. And how am I relating to that? Mm-hmm. Because it extends. I think of Pema Chodron a lot, you know, her question of like, am I going to peace today or am I going to war today or am I choosing peace? You know, like, 'cause we can do mm-hmm. that constantly. And you don't really have to look at the world wars, you know, to get a picture of what's going on. You just have to look at like the loops that are going on in your head and what you feel towards people that misunderstand you or mistreat you or,
Yeah, that's so true. It's like anything that's happening on a global scale is a reflection of, you know, the microcosmic experience that we're navigating as people. You know, it's whatever stands out to you. They say like, if it's standing out to you, it's hitting something that's real for you. You know, so when you look out at the world, the things that you're seeing, it's like Carl Jung says, what irritates you about something else or someone else is you. It's a quality you have. You know,
there's that quote, there's something about that guy I don't like about myself.
So good. There's something about that guy I don't like about myself.
Yeah.
I had to repeat that. That was good.
It's really good. Somebody told me that once. I think it was like on a dating app. So I have no idea who the sports quote is. But.
We'll have to Google that one and drop it in the show notes. But yeah, I mean, that's so true. And it's so human.
Yeah, of course.
Well, I love the direction that you're taking all of your work. I love the evolution that we can see. You've been a very public person for the last decade or so in the sobriety space. I love the way that you approach it too. It seems like you have a lot of respect for any attempt at sobriety or healthy, you know, a healthy relationship,
recovery. Yeah.
But I also see that you have like a really unique relationship to it. I've heard you say, I think I've heard you say that sobriety isn't part of your wellness strategy necessarily, you know? Yeah. And yeah. I think that's interesting because you hear about it in like a fitness context. That's like one of the.
Well, I mean, it's like anything, anything, right? Like anything. I was just reading a note I took down. I have to trace the source of it, but it was just like talking about how the pandemic produced so much pain that we then capitalized off of, you know? And like, I think when I first started doing the work I was doing, it was 2013 and Instagram was pretty new and influencing was pretty new. And I didn't say I want to be a sobriety influencer, but I also did not say that. I just used the tools that I had. And I really, really believed that capitalism would like the adoption of like capitalism embracing sobriety for conspicuous consumption, the same way that alcohol is conspicuous consumption. I really believe this, like if we brand sobriety and we give it like a good PR campaign, then it's going to reach more and more people. Well, that's fine. And that's true. It is. The culture is, reflects what we buy, and what we buy is reflective of the culture. Like what we're sold is essentially like what we end up buying. And it's just like this game of if this is not projected back to me, like by, you know, advertising, by brands, by you know, consumer culture, then it's not a real thing. And you know this, like rainbow washing, right? Like greenwashing. Like, and I think that what I have what I was really interested in happening in the beginning, which was like consumer culture's adoption of sobriety. I never really anticipated, and I didn't have enough like understanding of how capitalism works, how oppression works, or like the way that all these systems are interconnected, and or you know, like how much like actually free market and capitalist systems exacerbate addiction, right? By constantly selling us this like lack and this thing that will fill this lack. And so there was this turning point for me when there was a New York Times article and it was like the new sobriety is, you know, means you don't even have to quit drinking or something. And the new sobriety means you don't even have to really be sober. Which yes, you know, like great, like let's look at harm reduction models. But what they were saying, they had a picture of a bunch of dudes like in a WeWork doing cake stands of you know, LaCroix, of fizzy water. And all of a sudden it was just like this hit of like, oh my God, growth, you know, like they're taking this really subversive act, which is refusing alcohol and refusing the culture of alcohol and refusing like big alcohol and all these things that we just kind of like without our consent opt into. And now they're selling it back to us as another thing we have to achieve, another way of fitting in, another consumer product, another status symbol, and like another way of fitting in, right? Another way of being on trend. And I think that there was that like moment of, oh my God, this thing that like is like the power of my recovery and my sobriety has been that I have rejected like the mainstream narrative that I need alcohol in order to have sex or have a wedding or have fun or go on a date or you know, like, and through that rejection and the awareness that comes with refusing, you know, like one of the most, you know, popularized, legalized and consumed and deadly drugs, is that I have this awareness where I can make choices that allow me to be critical of the society I exist in, the culture I exist in, and it gives me this like growing ability to make choices for myself and not choices that are against myself. And I think that when we, you know, like sobriety is wellness, like this thing you have to, another, you know, like a six pack of abs or like a, you know, like a 7-step skin routine or like any other shit that we're constantly sold that makes us feel inadequate, you know, like it did get fed into that machine. And I think that we have to resist that. I think we have to like be grateful for the fruits of it, but I think we also have to resist this, like this idea that like sobriety is something that only corporate America can sell to us. You know, instead of this like very, very huge internal process change that allows us to unplug from a system that tells us we'll never be full as complete as humans without, you know, buying the next thing.
Yeah, I think that that's so interesting because I couldn't articulate it the way that you're articulating it right now, but I also don't drink alcohol, and I have always liked nice drinks, like like special tonics and elixirs and yummy drinks. So when, you know, these different companies came out with all these different alcohol-free mocktail mixes and drinks and everything, there was something about it I really liked, and I was like, yay, I'm buying everything. I'm gonna buy all the King came out with a new flavor, I'm buying this new flavor. But I mean, there was something I really appreciated about it, and people weren't getting drunk and they weren't drinking and driving, you know, and so I'm into it, you know. But I also could feel how expensive it all was. And how some of the richest girls in America own Kin now. And their entire lives are this very, you know, superficial, fashion, sexy, consumerist, capitalistic mansions and Ferraris and Bentleys and
status. Yeah, it fits this thing, but it still fits right back up into this thing that you will never attain.
It's like you're never going to be good enough. But maybe if you buy like this $8 canned soda that has special mushrooms in it, then maybe you'll be like me. And it's like, I don't feel it's not my intention to attack people personally or any of these companies, because we're in a system where it's like, you know, we have to do the things that we have to do. It's just that ultra elite energy of like a situation where I have to buy into it, a situation where you're irrelevant unless you really buy into it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I think is, it's harmful. And people don't realize, in my opinion, it's directly connected to all these very tragic suicides, you know, that we hear about, all these suicides. And some of these people, I had a friend who died by suicide last year on Thanksgiving, 2022. And I read through our conversations, our texts, our emails, our social media DMs, and such a beautiful person, such a sweet person, such a sweet spirit, such a good heart, always trying so hard to fit in, mm-hmm. always doing everything she possibly could to fit in, to look better, to accept her body as it is, but also to look better, to, you know, there was like the disordered eating battle for a while. There was a substance abuse battle for a while. And just seeing like, guys, that's actually capitalism. That's actually what did it. It was capitalism. People are like, she had a drug problem. It's not just that there was a substance abuse issue in there. It's that the substance abuse issue came from somewhere. And it's like this, the psyche of our system is so unwell. It's so desperate and in such pain and sick, so society. Sick.
Yeah. It makes me think of this. One of a man that has written a really great book, Died of Plisse. He was like one of the original people I met when I was trying to start my company in like 2014. He's written a book on integral recovery. He's one of, him and John DePuy were kind of these two pioneers in taking Ken Wilber's integral life map and moving it, like specifically creating this roadmap for recovery, of how to create a holistic recovery. But he and I were in, I think, Utah in like 2014. And he was talking about, I mean, it was still when I had my questions of like, what is it that causes addiction? What is it? Is it a life lottery? Is it, you know, like I remember so clearly him talking about the canary in the coal mine and how these things, like these, you know, like there was just this report that was released last week on the state of girls in America. And it is like, I have chills just even thinking about it. Just the rates of depression, rates of suicide, all kinds of different issues. And they're skyrocketing. The numbers are shocking. Mm-hmm. And you think about what the intersection, and I can't just say, I think like maybe a couple years ago, I would have said it's just capitalism. And I think that like, on the other side of saying it's all just capitalism, but I think mm-hmm. it is largely capitalism. But I when you look at you and like, we know this shit will never make us happy. All of us like can in conversation, like across so many demographics, so many life experiences, say we understand what advertising is, we understand marketing is, we understand like beauty standards and beauty culture and diet culture, and to a large degree, like this messaging that we're constantly fed, but that doesn't mean that our actions and our values are changing. It doesn't mean that how we spend our time is changing, what we model to children is changing, that we're creating support structures for mothers, for children. Like, it doesn't mean we're actually doing anything about it. And I think that that's what's so fascinating, is that we have words for this. We can completely understand that's not real. Like that, like the filters aren't real. You know, mm-hmm. Beauty culture and med spas and Botox and all that, that's not real. The way that 60-year-old women are supposed to look now, not real. You know, like it's all of this stuff we can say and we can see, but it doesn't actually, I think, often translate into the choices that we make. Again, like the choices right. that we make on a personal level, like in our everyday lives, of what we personally are going to do and how we're going to navigate this world and what choices that we're going to make and what sacrifices that we're going to make in order to choose something different. We're still ordering off of Amazon. You know, like we're still getting Botox. We're still like saying I look fat, you know, like and right. all sorts of shit that's like so completely toxic and perpetuates the cycle. And I think that that really is like, we keep on, I personally, my own experience, keep on reading article after article after article of the state of our mental health and the state of our rates of addiction. And it's just like, it feels like because we're getting fed so much of it, it's just this passing like, oh, shame, you know, 1 out of 10 girls are going to kill themselves in America, you know, mm-hmm. like, oh, shame. 140,000 people died in alcohol related death in 2021. Oh, shame. You know, like it's twice the number that it was 10 years ago. So it's just, I think that like, it again comes back down to the actions we ourselves truly, the decisions that we're making in our everyday lives of what we're paying our money into, of what we're spending our time doing, of how we treat other people, of what we model. And it's not easy, you know, it's just not like, it's not easy to live at this time, mm-hmm. but it's not, you know, I really do believe in a different future. I absolutely do. Mm-hmm. I know too many wonderful people that are doing too many wonderful things to believe mm-hmm. in a bleak future. Mm-hmm. But I think it's going to require all of us to do a lot of things different.
What are some of the things we need to do differently?
I think the things I just mentioned, you know, I mean, the reason I've written about recovery and sobriety so incessantly is because I was in a state of absolute disassociation and floating through my, like barely surviving through my life. Mm-hmm. And I had this experience, this really peak experience, and this really like fundamentally, like one of the hardest experiences you can go through, like active addiction. And I think that it was such a gift because it woke me up, you know, it was a really painful experience and there's not many choices that you can make there. You just keep going and you die, you know, a horrible death or you don't, you know, or you make different decisions. And you have to engage in your life. And then it's just this like burden of knowing too much. It's this burden of like awareness. You know, when you're out of integrity, you know, when you're out of alignment, you continue to develop this self-awareness. And you can do this not through like sobriety and recovery. You can do this through like the loss of like a dream, the loss of a partner, the loss of a child, like any sort of like, you know, a near-death experience. There's a lot of things that can happen in our lives that are extremely painful and unfortunate and horrific and terrible that also serve as catalysts for us to like not get away with it anymore. And I think that I do think that when it comes down to it, I had this like hope in the pandemic at the beginning of it, that the pain of it and the like the pain it unveiled that was already happening, that we wouldn't go back to how we were. And I'm obsessed with post-apocalyptic films and stories mm-hmm. because it's just so beautiful to me. It just strips away at all of it, you know, and we're just left with the things that actually matter. And I think that the things that we can do individually are just figure out like what's our biggest pain point, you know, what's our addiction or what's our thing that we are denying, that we might have a small awareness of, that's not like that thing that like keeps us up at night, and looking at that thing and using that as a door to walk through to start to connect to ourselves and to start to live in more integrity personally, and then do the work that like requires us to pay attention to the voice that we all have within us. And I think the more and more, you know, like there's a lot of discourse right now about like, that's good. It's about, you know, beauty culture. And like, I'm part of the discourse on alcohol culture. There's all these cultures. There's all this systematic woe, you know, and we can get caught up in that now and then just blame the entire fucking system, which we should. But also, I think what I'm saying is that a lot of healthy choices are made from the place of not getting away with it anymore within ourselves, and actually mm-hmm. like creating this connection to ourselves as teacher, as lover, as faith holder, as like wise person, you know, like there's so mm-hmm. much depth and richness within us that we are not accessing, that we, because it is terrifying and because it requires work to get there and it requires giving up our favorite ways of like completely disconnecting from ourselves. So I still think it's recovery. Like it mm-hmm. comes back to me of this sense of like this recovering of this, like, you know, Marianne Williamson's one of your friends, or yeah, mm-hmm. right. Return to love. Like this, like, you know, the line at a podcast called Home a couple of years ago, because that's what recovery was. It was like returning home. And that line from her book in A Return to Love is like, there was a path away and there was a path back. And I think that like a majority of us are still on the path away, and mm-hmm. that it's the path, it's that turning and that path back to our eternal knowing and the like what we've got, you know. And it's really not, it's not easy, but it's also not complicated. It's pretty simple, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's some of the hardest things are really uncomplicated.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I love that reminder. There was a path away, but there's a path back.
Yeah. And it's a necessary path to travel, because like the path away is what, you know, like, and like, it's what makes it so good, you know, like it's what makes it so fun and like so adventurous. And like, it just, life is good, not because it's easy, you know, like right. It's good because it's a fucking mysterious adventure, right? That's what right. makes it good. You know, mm-hmm. your best movies, like the best stories are not ones where everything just stays the same and nothing happens, you know, like, it's the one where shit goes wrong and people, you know, are in it. And like, just look at like The Last of Us, you know, everyone's watching The Last of Us, like it's a zombie apocalypse and like, their life sucks. And, you know, and it's beautiful.
Right. So. Right. It's like super intense. And there's like monsters coming out of the ground with mushrooms growing out of their faces. And also
so good.
You see like the, where they go, you know, emotionally with each other, and you see the humanity, like when push comes to shove, like this ruthless man is going to, you know, care for this other person, or, you know,
yeah.
Yeah. That The Last of Us, that's a definite watch. That's on the watch list.
Oh, you haven't watched it yet.
Okay. No. I mean, for the listeners. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I've definitely watched it. I've watched every episode. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Good. Yeah. But that's it exactly. Which is like, it's just, it's beautiful. It's just, you're watching like when humanity's stripped down, you know, and we're not like completely distracted by shit that doesn't matter. It's actually really good.
You know? I couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. That's the, you know, in Buddhism, there's the three primary schools, right? The Theravada, or like the Hinayana path, the Mahayana path, and the Vajrayana path. That first path is about mindfulness and it's sort of like the path of individual liberation. So it's liberating oneself from one's own inner limitations. And then it sort of like evolves into the next path, which is the Mahayana path, where you live for the benefit of other beings. Mm.
And that's like Mahayana is Tibetan, right?
Yeah.
No. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I never get them right. Okay. And then what's the third one? Vajrayana.
Yeah. And the third one, Vajrayana, comes, it really blossoms out of Mahayana, okay. You know, just like the Mahayana sprouts out of the Hinayana, but it's really the masterful application of the first two schools. So the Vajrayana is the more advanced application of the individual liberation practices as they relate to all other living beings. So that Vajrayana school is about like the techniques that you have to pass through the other schools in order to have the initiatory introductions to those more advanced techniques. And it's kind of like humanity is passing through almost like that first level. It's like humanity has the global access not everywhere, but in a way we haven't before, for some of us who have like internet and technology access. Yeah. And so because of that, there's like that first step, that first initiation, which is like the realization. Yeah. And it's like truly available here. And you're right, it has to happen on a personal level before it can happen, before any of the big stuff could ever happen. You know, our impact is gonna seem small in this lifetime, in these little moments. But we have to do that. I remember stories from my parents as little kids, little things other people did when we were broke as shit and living in a trailer, little acts of kindness that people did that made a difference, that changed the whole trajectory of my entire life, of everything I ever did, you know?
Yeah. So tiny little things.
Yeah.
Tiny little things.
You mentioned Marianne, something she says is, if you're going deep, it's not small.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, but again, there's this, and I think that like we're in a period of time where there's public pressure for us to all be like doing everything outside of ourselves all the time.
Right.
And that is like, you know, there's criticism on it because like, again, like self-care, you know, is like this like beautiful thing that came from like the Black feminist, the liberation movement. Like this idea of like actually taking care of oneself while you were giving, but now is like an entire industry of like
self-indulgence,
you know, like it turns into self-indulgence. Right. And I think that like, there's just, so it's lost its like actual core, you know, idea of like really just turning in and healing what's there. What is it, just for my edification? So it's, I'm sorry, you said it was Theravada first.
Theravada and Hinayana. Theravada and Hinayana are there together in the
and
first.
And what are they? Is that like Zen? Like, what are some of the schools?
Yeah,
that
Zen. Okay. When you hear about things like mindfulness, Vipassana, those are all associated with what we call the path of individual liberation.
Okay, and then Mahayana is like. The
greater way. Yeah, the Bodhisattva, the way of the Bodhisattva, Tibetan Buddhism, the Dalai Lama, that's all Mahayana.
And then what is Vajrayana?
Vajrayana is an esoteric, much smaller community that is central to the most advanced initiates within Mahayana.
So is that Shambhala? Is there like a school that's associated with it?
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's like Shambhala. Well, the way that you would look at it is, this is the way I see it. Sa might describe it differently as a practitioner. You know, he has his own relationship to it. But the way I see it is Mahayana is what you hear from the Dalai Lama publicly. Vajrayana is what the Dalai Lama practices in private.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, so the Vajrayana, I see it as like becoming a divine incarnation almost. Like it's really like serious about those like advanced spiritual principles, but it sprouts out of the Mahayana. So, and even... Okay. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who is the founder of the monastery we were just in Nepal last year for a month. One of the talks he gave was he made a big deal. He was like, there is no Vajrayana without Mahayana.
Yeah.
And the significance of that is Vajrayana is the path of indestructible wakefulness.
Yeah.
So it's total wakefulness at all times and conscious working with like guru yoga or deity yoga. So you do a lot of work with like a Vajrasattva, other deities like the Taras and the different Buddha families who all have like certain things that they rule that you work with, you know, really consciously. That's more like the Vajrayana tantric Buddhism practices. Yeah. Yeah. And Mahayana is really about like you give of yourself until there's no more giving, until there's no more, you know.
Beautiful.
And, Thank you. And then you're going to die and then you're going to reincarnate and you're going to do it again and again and again until all beings have no suffering.
Liberated. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So those are the three. Yeah. Well, I'm so excited about your new book and.
Well, it's not happening. I mean, I'm just starting it.
I'm excited for here's what I want to say. I'm excited about your first book, Quit Like a Woman. You have here. If you're watching it on video, I'm holding it up. What I love is the evolution and the direction of the evolution of your work and where you're taking that. So that's what I mean by I'm excited about the next book.
Thank you. And can I also plug my newsletter? I write weekly on Substack. You can find it at hollywhitaker.substack.com. Read me there.
Yeah, and we'll put that. Yeah, hollywhitaker.substack.com. I'll put that in the show notes.
Thank you.
And you're a great writer and, Of course, I can see that you have honed the craft, but also what I love about your writing is your ideas, your mind. You're very psychic. You're very prophetic. I feel like you're very tuned into a deeply subtle truth that's happening. Mm-hmm. And you're masterfully articulating some very important truths and, may you live a very long life and may millions experience your wisdom.
Thank you. Oh my God. What a lovely thing. Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate you to death, Ben. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate you too. Well, let's do this again sometime.
Yeah.
Okay. Take care.
Hey, it's Ben Decker, and I just have to thank you again for listening to the Modern Spirituality Podcast. For information on anything mentioned here, you can check out the show notes below. You can also get in touch with me via twitter.com/BenDecker, instagram.com/BenjaminWDecker, or email me at BenDecker@ModernSpiritualityPodcast.com. It really does mean so much to me that you're here with me on the modern spirituality journey. I'm genuinely super excited about what I've got planned for these next few episodes. So really make sure to subscribe to the Modern Spirituality Podcast so you can get in on what I've got coming up. And if this is resonating for you, if anything here helped or inspired or entertained you at all, please, please do rate this podcast and leave me a review. It means so much more than you might realize. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you again.